You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures. Today on Sustainable Futures, we have Andy Miller of the Wilderness Committee.
We've gone from 1,000 spotted owls down to 6. You know, we've gone from 1,500 grizzly bears down to 17. The evidence is mounting that something needs to be done, and soon, if we are to keep any semblance of ecological health in our old-growth forests.
And the second interview is with Stan Wilson of Permabus.
We went on the road in February of 2007, and we stayed on the road until November of 2008. And when we go on the road, we'll be on the road all year. We'll probably take a couple of months off at some point and then go back. And we're committed to doing the tour for as long as people want us to.
Welcome to today's episode of Sustainable Futures.
This is Ryan Fletcher with
Maria Persdotter,
who's from Sweden and a student here at SFU. Today we're going to talk about dedication and how people are dedicated to sustainability. We've got quite a few interesting people here who definitely have a very, very big commitment. The first will be Andy Miller from the Wilderness Committee. And the people in the Wilderness Committee, they put in long hours for very little pay, and it's at 99% volunteer, so that's obviously no pay at all. But still, it's a very big and successful organization, so there's one example of dedication.
And then our second interview is going to be with Stan Wilson, who is doing this really interesting thing. He and his family has been traveling around the U.S. for almost a year now, teaching people about sustainability. And they're traveling in this bus that is actually like it's fully equipped for a truly sustainable lifestyle. Mm-hmm. They have a herb garden and several other really interesting things on this bus. So
yeah, it's like a traveling teaching tool that they have that's going from place to place. So they actually live in this bus, and they spend all of their time teaching people about sustainability.
Yeah, that's dedication.
And then we're going to show you how you can get involved by playing some more audio from the Sustainability Festival that happened last year. Some interviews with different clubs from the local area that are involved in sustainable initiatives. And first will be the interview with Andy Miller. This is Ryan Fletcher from Sustainable Futures, and we're interviewing Andy Miller from the Wilderness Committee today. Thank you for joining us on the show.
You're welcome.
First of all, tell the listeners here, what is the Wilderness Committee?
Well, we are Canada's largest membership-based environmental group. So the difference being that our strength comes from numbers. We have 50,000 folks who write us small checks on a regular basis to keep us alive and are ready to jump to our defense if we need them. For example, showing up at a rally, making a phone call, sending an email to a politician about some environmental atrocity that we've found out about. So we're sort of the grassroots bulldog of the environmental movement.
Okay, great. Was it 50,000 you said?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, what is the importance of old growth?
Well, historically, old growth forests dominated the all West Coast rainforest landscapes. And of course, with industrialization, we've lost almost all of them at low elevations. And the parks that we have are mostly at high elevations. And the so we always make a big distinction between the parks that we have, which are mostly mountaintops and higher elevation forests, and the lower elevation really productive forests where 99% of everything lives, and of course where people prefer to hike and recreate as well. And in the Lower Mainland in particular, we are one of the few regions in BC without a land use plan to guide decision-making about how our old-growth forests, for example, are used. And as a result, development decisions tend to be arbitrary and or favoring industrial development instead of environmental protection or recreational use.
So would this guide be a body of law?
Pardon me?
This guide you're telling, this land use guide that is non-existent, would that be a kind of a body of law? A document?
Yes. So land use plans are legally binding documents that result from provincial and municipal government planning processes which aim to carve up a landscape and so that all users and, in this case, all areas of ecological importance have some representation. And in the Lower Mainland, we don't have one. And one of the reasons we don't have one is because our forests are so proximate to urban centers and highways, and there's so much road development in the backcountry that it's relatively inexpensive to get old growth forests from the forest to the marketplace. And the result of which is that we live in one of the most abused landscapes in all of BC. You know, from the very first pioneers who showed up, we have consistently been hammering away at our old growth forests in the Lower Mainland, mm-hmm. in particular. The result of that is that, you know, we've gone from 1,000 spotted owls down to 6. You know, we've gone from 1,500 grizzly bears down to 17. The evidence is mounting that something needs to be done, mm-hmm. and soon, if we are to keep any semblance of ecological health mm-hmm. In our old-growth forests. And what the Wilderness Committee is calling for is a complete moratorium on all logging of old-growth forests in the Lower Mainland permanently,
right.
Because there's so few left. You know, there are no large patches of old-growth forests left that are, you know, below 1,000 feet in elevation. There's none. They're all gone. There's lots of little bits and pieces left, and those are even being haven't been logged historically, you know, the little bits and pieces that are left, because just isn't economically viable to do it. But now
right.
it increasingly is, because, you know, our options are running out in other areas of the province to get wood to market. So logging companies are going into these last little pockets of old growth that are hidden in these deep, dark valleys that be, you know, 30 miles up the river from pit meadows or something, and they're logging them and bringing the wood to market. And the result ecologically is just a catastrophe regarding all of the species of wildlife and plants that have some kind of a dependency ecologically on old growth forests. So clearly something has to be done. Something has to be done soon. And what we're calling for first is just a land use plan to at least start the process where the provincial and municipal governments bring all the stakeholders together to start talking about
right.
you know, what needs to be done and how we're going to carve up this pie so that, you know, we can have industry and jobs and environmental protection all at the same time. And there's no reason it can't be done. It's been done in lots of other places, but
mm-hmm.
it's been industry first, environment second for 250 years, and it's got to end.
I would think for sustainable forestry, there would have to be a common interest anyway. Like,
surprisingly not. You know, BC is really a third world country in how it makes its money. You know, we are a mass exporter of minimally finished commodities, i.e., you know, raw logs, 2x4s. You know, we don't make nice stuff out of our wood because we didn't ever have to. We had so much that we just cut it down, minimally processed it, if we processed it at all, and stuck it on a train or a boat and sent it somewhere else. And then they made the furniture out of it. They made the nice things out of it. And now as when we're running out, we just simply can't afford to do that anymore. And that's really why you've seen the collapse of the forest industry throughout BC, is this third world mentality that we have. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, these interests are very entrenched. They're huge multinational corporations that have invested a ton of money in how they do business, and they don't want to give. And what it takes is leadership from both provincial and municipal governments, and the feds as well, to guide these industries towards a more sustainable future. Because, you know, you don't see big multinational companies that have, you know, billions of dollars of investments advocating for change. You know, they're the least likely thing to be advocating for change. But that's how our decision-making is structured in BC, is that we rely on these people because there's no land use plan to guide them. So therefore, they just dig themselves a deeper and deeper and deeper hole, and eventually they go bankrupt. And we shouldn't wait until that happens. We should be proactive and help them out of their hole that they've dug for themselves because of their Stone Age attitude towards resource management. And that time will come. It just is it's this long, slow, arduous process. And meanwhile, the unfortunate part is that species are going extinct. And that's why, for the short term, we want an immediate moratorium on all logging of old-growth forests.
I'm just a little bit curious about the advantages of an old-growth versus a second-growth.
Old-growth forests, the reason why they're so special is that they're really not old, which is seems like a contradiction, but ecologically, an old-growth forest is a mixture of lots of different forest types. So as a forest grows older and older and older, they become more ecologically diverse because, say, a tree starts out and it grows for 400, 500, 600 years. And then you get a whole forest of these trees that are 500 or 600 years old. And then, you know, they gradually start to fall over. You know, a big windstorm comes or a lightning storm comes, or maybe it's a species of tree which, you know, only lives to 600 or 700 years old, and it falls over. And when it falls over, it takes out quite a big swath of forest. And then younger forest grows up to replace it. So you've got all of this diversity that happens because of that. So you have forests of many different ages in an old-growth forest, and thus you have species of wildlife and plants that are capable of living in lots of different forests occurring in old-growth forests. So they're incredibly diverse.
Okay.
And in addition to that, you've got all of these species that through time became dependent on the old-growth part of the old-growth forest. And species that become dependent on old-growth forests can't live anywhere else. I mean, there's a reason why species live in certain types of forests, just like there's a reason why we live in houses instead of caves. You know, they, you know, we've all developed evolutionary dependencies on a certain way of life, and you just can't log an old-growth forest and expect the species that live there to live in a second-growth forest because their ecological needs are not met. You know, the foods that they're dependent on aren't there. Maybe in the case of the spotted owl, they're dependent on flying squirrels for food. Mm-hmm. And flying squirrels, in turn, are dependent on a certain kind of truffle, which is a mycorrhizal fungi that lives underneath the soil. And its fibers link old-growth trees and help old-growth trees exchange nutrients between each other.
Mm-hmm.
So when you take out the old-growth component, you take out the truffles, you take out the flying squirrels, you take out the spotted owls. It's very much this web of life, you know, the spider web that kids learn about in the sixth grade. Well, it's real, and it's true, and here's a real example of it right here. So, yeah, you develop, you know, all species develop dependencies upon the environment in which they live. Old-growth forests have always been the most rare forest type, and now they're extremely rare, and the species just are unable to cope with its loss.
Mm-hmm. Where are most old-growth areas?
Well, old-growth forests that remain are, almost by their definition, those that are located farthest from humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at Google Earth,
You zoom over, you know, southwestern BC and the west coast of BC, you'll start seeing old growth forests have a certain look from, the, you know, I can identify them on Google Maps. And as you zoom around, you know, the farther you are from a road, the farther you are from a community, the more of these forests that you'll find.
Right.
Unfortunately, helicopter logging is becoming more and more prevalent because a lot of these areas you simply can't build roads back into because the terrain is so steep and or unstable. Old growth forests are the least common in the lower mainland, and as you move north, they become more common. But there's a phenomenon that almost every river valley in western BC has a road up it and has been logged to a greater or lesser degree. And the old growth that's left behind tends to be up on the side slopes of a valley on really steep, unstable terrain, which during the time that they logged, maybe 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, simply wasn't commercially viable to be able to access it because it was just too expensive to build a road up there, too expensive to fly helicopters back there to log it all. And so there's old growth that's remaining, but because this old growth is on really steep, rocky, unstable terrain, well, duh, it's also less important to wildlife, right? So what we're really talking about is low elevation river valley bottom old growth, which are these narrow threads, which you'll see if you zoom over western BC on Google Earth. You'll see all these threads of dark green in the river valleys of regrowing forests, and you'll see a few patches of old growth forests left in those that were left behind, in some cases for deer winter range habitat, because deer need some place to go during big winter storms, and they go into the old growth. And government has done a reasonably good job at protecting small swaths of old growth forest for deer, but that's it. They haven't protected old growth forest for anything else, and the only reason why deer got the protection is because they have an economic value to hunters. So,
isn't that
ironic? We just need to multiply this model that the government has developed for deer to represent a host of other species, and what we're asking for is that all old growth forests be immediately off limits for logging, and as these river valley bottom forests grow up over the next 100 or 200 or 300 years, you know, it takes 300 years for a forest to become old growth, that fully half of them be permanently set aside for environmental purposes and for recreational purposes as well. And only then do the scientists say that you'll restore biological diversity to a level at which extinction is no longer a threat, which has huge implications. I mean, if we're going to protect half of our, you know, of our really productive low-elevation forested landscape, that has a huge implication for industry. And what it says is that we just can't do business as usual. You know, we've got to change, and we've got to become like Sweden and like a lot of other countries throughout Western and Northern Europe, including Japan, including some Southeast Asian countries, where they've set huge amounts of their forest off limits for industrial purposes, and they've changed the nature of their extractive resource industries so that they get more value out of what they dig up or mine or cut down before they export it. So instead of exporting raw trees or 2x4s, you're exporting cabinets and furniture and door moldings and, you know, high-end finished things, which result in more direct employment in small communities throughout BC, and you don't have to log anywhere as much to get the same value out of, in this case, the old-growth wood that you cut down. So that model could, in fact, increase the level of economic activity that happens, the level of employment in small communities, could be a huge boon for the logging industry because our wood here is of such incredible high quality. I mean, it's just a waste to use it for stupid stuff that we've used it for the past couple of hundred years. So it is economically possible to have a dramatic change, and it's ecologically possible to see a recreation of historic levels of biodiversity, but that doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, that happens with bold leadership, and that's why we really need to see provincial governments and federal governments elected that take those issues seriously and are willing to be bold leaders in sort of reshaping and reformulating our economy from one which is inherently third world developing country to one which is a modern industrial country.
I have a question from the logging point of view. Is there something about old growth trees besides what is probably a much larger size that has quality?
Yes. As they get older, they grow slower. So that means that the quality of the wood increases dramatically. The structural integrity of a 20-year-old tree versus a 100-year-old tree,
I guess it would be
a 300-year-old
more solid.
Tree, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
So, you know, you would use a 50-year-old tree or a 100-year-old tree to make 2x4s for construction. You should use 200 or 300-year-old trees to make violins and cabinets and things that need more durability.
Okay.
Unfortunately, in BC, we've done exactly the opposite. So we sort of squandered this incredible resource that we had simply because we had so much. You know, there was a total lack of appreciation for its value.
Right. Not really specializing on what you're using for what.
Yeah. So I, for example, did my master's and my PhD in forestry because I really want to see a change. And, we've got more and more people who are speaking out about this. But unfortunately, it's going to take really bold leadership and a lot of investment from our leadership to see these kind of things happen. But it is a foregone conclusion. It has to happen. I mean, there's nothing else that could happen. It's just going to be painful for the industries involved because, they're going to have to change. And yes, their shareholders are going to make a little bit less money for a while they retool.
Yeah. Which is really the issue most of the times, isn't it?
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah, for them.
Yeah, so until we shift away from a fixation on a short-term profit making, switches like that are very hard to make. And that's why you tend to see progressive governments who don't have huge connections to industry and the status quo making those kinds of decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're listening to Sustainable Futures, and this is Ryan Fletcher interviewing Andrew Miller from the Wilderness Committee.
What are some current threats? Are there any current threats to certain areas right now?
Oh, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. Yeah. The BC government has taken the power away from BC Hydro to develop new hydro developments and has given it to industry, and they're promoting that, so far over 600 streams and rivers throughout BC be dammed, put into pipes, rerouted to generate power for export to the U.S. And in some cases, the locations they've selected are fine. And in a lot of cases, they're not. And they simply don't have a good environmental accountability process to effectively evaluate these things. And they've given it over to industry, which has, their bottom line has nothing to do with, with the environment or the well-being of surrounding communities. It comes down to pleasing their shareholders, right? So this kind of economic model, just is so antithetical to not only the health of the environment in BC, but the health of small communities throughout BC, because both of them get screwed when this kind of decision-making proliferates. So there's one example that is happening throughout BC of, in all of the infrastructure and the road building that's necessary to put these little micro hydro projects in all over the province causes incredible damage to precisely the ecosystem we need to be prioritizing for protection, which are low elevation forests, which currently have old growth on them or could in the future as they regrow. Other ones, spotted owl is a great one. The most endangered animal in Canada, has gone from something which was, quite frankly, as common as stink a few hundred years ago because we had so much old growth forest, to now, there's only 6 spotted owls left in the province, and they're forecast for extinction by the time the 2010 Olympics happen. And that's, purely because of old growth logging. We also have, up at high elevations, we're putting a lot of energy into grizzly bears. And because of the proliferation of roads and motorized recreation in the form of, you know, all train vehicles, motorbikes, and skidoos up in the high country has wrecked a lot of grizzly bear habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen grizzly bear populations all over southern BC are just collapsing simply because they're intolerant of motorized vehicles. They just, you know, they don't, the bears don't like to cross roads, and when they hear a motorized vehicle in habitat that's important to them, they just abandon it.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that with mountain goats, you see that with caribou, you see that with lots of different animals that live in the high country, so we really need some really strong regulation.
Does that ever get looked at, you know, in the decision room? Like, people ever even think of that? Because that's something that I kind of recognize as being something that happens quite a lot, but I always wonder if people even consider that when they're making these decisions.
Sure, I think they're all. I think all of the industries in the that are involved in
specifically the motor,
in some kind of organized motorized
recreation
in the high country, are aware of this kind of stuff, but they really don't appreciate how severe the threat is.
Yeah.
And it all comes down to zoning. It's quite simple. I mean, there are areas where the grizzly bears and the mountain goats and the caribou don't live. And we're saying, okay, look, the environment over there is perfect for your activity. You know, we just need the zoning. We just need some guidelines for you to go over there and for the, you know, the caribou and everything over it will be over here and everything will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But they're so used to, you know, having the run of the roost that they take even some relatively insignificant small recommendations like that and consider it a threat. And on the level of the individual who's not part of an organized skidoo club, for example, who's just up there, you know, how is he supposed to know? You know, I mean, scientists really only figured out some of these threats very recently. So how is, you know, Joe Blow from Surrey, who likes to ride his motorbike up in the high country, supposed to know that it's bad for grizzly bears? I mean, you know, you got to, you know, so this is, again, a case where unless you have, I should say, government exists for a purpose. And in my mind, environmentally, purpose of government is to educate the citizens about, you know, how to reach peace with the natural environment and how to compromise and which activities are appropriate where and how and why and when. And in BC, just because, you know, we have had this third world extractive resource economy, which is based on, you know, mass export of minimally finished crap, the discussion is not focused on that kind of leadership. It's been industrial leadership, and it's been a complete lack of concern for building an articulate and educated citizenry. These are big things which, you know, we're going to have to start addressing. You know, the environment is just such an excellent example of how we can go forward and take these gradual baby steps forward. And yes, we're going to lose species. It's inevitable that things are going to go extinct in the process. But we really have to start taking those first steps. And that's why I harp on this one thing, which is a super first step, is to, you know, for us all to go through these collective land use planning processes where, you know, all stakeholders get brought together and we start talking about this stuff and start carving up the landscape and saying, okay, logging is appropriate here, skidooing is appropriate here, but this area over here, it's really important for grizzly bears, guys.
Let's talk a little bit about what the Wilderness Committee does. What does the Wilderness
Committee do in this? Our sort of basic strategy at the Wilderness Committee to address environmental issues is first to identify them. Which areas are important for spotted owls? Which areas are important for government? Which areas should be off limits to hydro development? Because our government has been so focused on pleasing industry for, you know, hundreds of years, even the government most of the time doesn't know which areas are important, which areas are not. So it comes down to on the onus of common everyday Joe Blows like me and you to actually spend time out in the woods and learn about science and learn about forestry and learn about mining and pore over maps and become educated and try and find areas that are still relatively intact or that have endangered species in them and become advocates for their protection. And how we do that is once we've identified them, we draw lines around them, we map them, we make posters for distribution to the public of the endangered species that live there. We make little newspapers and educational cards, hundreds of thousands of copies of them, and distribute them via knocking on doors. You know, we have teams of canvases and seven cities that just go around and knock on doors and talk to people and hand out our printed material on this, that, and the other environmental issue and ask people to get involved and write your local politician, send them an email, make a phone call, show up at a rally, you know, dress up in a polar bear suit, whatever, do something to get active. And for the most part, folks are really yearning for that, we found, you know, because there is such a history of sort of non-participation because people are alienated from the political system because it's all been favored towards industry. So that's why hardly anybody votes, you know, because, well, why bother? It doesn't make any difference if I vote, right? So we're gradually sort of changing that by talking to one person at a time, and we've been around for 30 years now. And we've grown, you know, just, you know, one member after another member after another member to now we're the largest environmental group in the country. And we're a pretty powerful force to be reckoned with. You know, we don't mince our words. We tell the truth. We have scientists like myself on staff. We have clear, rational policies that we advocate. And we've got a ton of people who are acting on our behalf. Mm-hmm. So we make these recommendations to government and on behalf of the people, you know, all we do is develop the ideas and get the issues formulated into packages which can be consumed by our leaders, and then we let our members deliver the message. And their message is they pick up the phone and they say, hey, you know, this is an important issue. You know, you've got to deal with the issue of protecting habitat for grizzly bears in southwestern BC, and if you don't, we're not going to vote for you. And you get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people making those phone calls and doing that, and politicians listen. Democracy works if people participate in it. So that's what we're sort of all about.
And there's been some big rallies lately.
Right. That's classic Wilderness Committee stuff, is we're capable, because we're so big and we're so grassroots, of turning out just masses and masses of people. So, you know, whenever there's a big rally of a bunch of environmentalists or conservationists or scientists in BC advocating on behalf of the environment, you know that our name's behind it, because we're really the only group that's capable of turning out these big numbers, you know. So, you know, we always have the biggest of this and the biggest of that, and it's evolved into an incredibly effective tool at, you know, one little bit at a time, we're getting areas protected. So it did sound like there's a lot of doom and gloom out there, but there's also, you know, there's 45 big new parks that the Wilderness Committee has its name behind all over the province. So we're sort of gradually chipping away at it, but we've only protected about one-tenth of our landscape in BC, and the scientists say we have to protect a half of it. So, you know, there's a lot of work to do still to go.
And what happens at these rallies?
Oh, we just get people holding signs and handing in petitions that they've gathered, and we'll have sensitive politicians or business leaders there making speeches, and the media comes and covers it, and the media reports it to the public, and the politicians, what do they do at night? They watch the news. Yeah. And they see the Wilderness Committee had a rally with 3,000 people on the lawn of the legislature about ending old-growth logging. Oh, my God. We better address this. So, you know, it's although it sounds like a big ask, I think it's quite reasonable to expect within the next year or two to see just that. I wouldn't, and it doesn't matter what political party it is. It, you know, historically, it doesn't matter who's in office. Certain change happens regardless of your political affiliation. Change happens when politicians think that a lot of people are standing up and are concerned about something.
I think more than anything they would see the passion, because that passion, if they don't
right
if they don't do it, that passion turns into anger, disgust. So,
right, and a lot of it, and a lot of it is emotional. A lot of people, you know, because sometimes environmentalists get a bit of a short shift for, you know, being emotional about stuff. But what's wrong with being emotional about, you know, species becoming extinct? You know, it's grounded in science, and yes, we're upset. We're going to yell and scream and hold rallies and make signs that accuse politicians of evil atrocities, and we're going to do this because, you know, that's how change happens. I mean, humans are emotional beasts, and there's nothing to be ashamed of regarding showing our emotions, you know. So we're going to sort of mix emotions and science in a whatever way that's going to create change.
That's great. How does someone get involved
Well, that's the nice thing about the Wilderness Committee is that, you know, because we're so grassroots, you know, we're sort of membership-based and that, you know, we have offices all over the place and our strength comes from volunteers. I mean, there's very few staff people here. People think we're some huge institutional organization, and we're not. We're just a handful of underpaid people who know how to puff up like puffer fish, and almost all of our work, quite frankly, is done by volunteers who just come in and give an hour here, an hour there, and anything from stuffing envelopes to designing websites and helping out and helping us to write and get messages out and make phone calls and organize rallies and events and meetings. And so, yeah, the opportunities for involvement are as diverse as we are, I guess, and tend to be not as mundane as most people would think a volunteer job would be. It tends to be quite interesting and quite enlightening. Yeah. And lots of learning experiences, yeah. So.
Yeah, it sounds like it'd be fun to me.
Yeah.
Is there a website so people can find out where their nearest office is? Or
right. Yeah. We're at wildernesscommittee.org, wildernesscommittee.org, and we're just going through a big new website redesign, so within weeks we're going to be launching this brand new, even more user-friendly website, which is really focused on helping just, you know, ordinary people out there who have some concerns about the environment to log on and find a way that they can quickly and efficiently, without a whole lot of time, get involved.
I just found an interesting, the expression log on. The log. That never occurred to me before.
Yeah.
I wonder what that's about.
Yeah, so that, you know, there's lots and lots of ways.
Anyways.
To get involved.
Oh, great. Well, that's really good. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about here while you have the chance?
No, I guess, you know, for people in the Lower Mainland in particular, you know, there's lots of different environmental groups too, right? And people sometimes are a little bit confused about what all the different environmental groups do. Mm-hmm. And we all exist in sort of a hierarchy, and we're sort of at the bottom of the rung. You know, we're the people who generate a lot of the initial ideas about conservation and help communicate that to the masses of people out in the Fraser Valley. And then once an idea sticks, you know, it's got some kind of traction because some kind of political opportunity coming up, like an election, then other groups will come in and will take the ideas that regenerate and will make them more, they'll refine them and make them more palatable and bring industry spokespeople on side as a result of their compromising. Mm-hmm. And slowly, you know, an issue will build champions. The more groups that take it on and take it up to higher and higher levels, and then, you know, finally at the very end, you know, groups like, you know, the David Suzuki Foundation or, you know, Sierra Club will come in, and, you know, they're the groups that really specialize in, you know, taking an environmental proposal and bringing it to the politicians directly and sitting down and having meetings and talking it over with the politicians and finding areas of compromise and agreement. And it's really depends on a person's interest, which environmental group they get involved with, whether they're really interested in, you know, high-level backroom policy and, you know, what happens in those boardrooms and stuff, or if they're really interested in just doing grassroots stuff like heading out to the bush with us and hiking in these mysterious, dark, hidden valleys and looking for endangered species and then communicating that message to Joe Blow out in Surrey and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking with Andy Miller of the Wilderness Committee, and this is Sustainable Futures.
So that was the interview with Andy Miller. Sustainable Futures have made some connections with the Wilderness Committee, and we can look forward to some updates on what they're doing.
And then next we're going to have the Stan Wilson interview, and Stan Wilson is a kind of an adventurer, even.
Yeah, definitely.
He's a sustainability adventurer and teacher. That's kind of traveling around avant-garde with his Permabus. So we're going to learn all about that.
So this is Ryan Fletcher interviewing Stan Wilson of the Skills for the New Millennium Tour. Welcome to Sustainable Futures. It's a real thrill to have you on.
Oh, thank you, Ryan. It's a real thrill to be on, too.
Okay, so what is this Skills for New Millennium?
Well, the Skills for the New Millennium Tour is a nonprofit that my family and I formed a couple years ago. And what we have seen is that as the economy gets more and more troublesome, and as people become more factionalized and just the normal way of living becomes more and more difficult, What we are doing is we're going on the road and we're teaching people what we're calling skills for the new millennium, and a lot of that is how to prepare your own food, how to meet some of your own medical needs, how to meet your own energy need. We teach about solar power and rainwater catchment and using gray water systems and using humanure systems and just a lot of different things that people can do to make their lives easier as, you know, the current environment becomes more and more troublesome.
Okay. So is this planning for climate change as the climate continues to change, living with circumstances after the climate has changed kind of thing?
Well, it's not really directed towards necessarily about climate change in particular. Climate change is one of the issues that people are having to deal with more and more. Some of the other issues are is that, you know, along with climate change, there's also economic distress. More and more people are finding it more and more difficult to live in the fashion in which we have become accustomed to living here in the West, especially in the United States. So we do address some climate change issues. We do that mainly by teaching things like organic gardening on a small scale and using chickens to be part of a composting system, which allows people to not only grow food, but also to sequester carbon in the ground where it's not a problem, where it's not adversely affecting climate change. So climate change is just one of the many elements that are involved in finding different, more sustainable ways to live.
Mm-hmm. And so the way this works is you're traveling around, and where do you go? Do you go to events, or do you go to people's doorsteps, or how does that work?
Well, we go to a lot of different things. We go to festivals and fairs. We go to college campuses. We hold trainings on people's properties. We've held trainings in people's living rooms, in city parks, like I say, in fairs and festivals, college campuses, just, you know, inner city gardens, just anywhere that people want to host us, we go to. And, you know, we have ourselves set up to be very, very elastic. We can do trainings that are as small as 5 people. We can do trainings that are as large as, you know, 50 to 100 people.
How long is a typical training? And is there a set order of way things go, or do you adapt it every time?
Well, we adapt it every time. What we do, instead of coming into the community and telling you what we think you need to know, what we do is we come into a community and we ask what you want to learn, and then we hold those particular skill sets, and then we teach that. Oftentimes when we're going to fairs and festivals, what we're doing a lot of is simply tours of the Permibus and showing the systems and talking a little bit about how it was built and how we use it and how we use it to live in, as well as a teaching tool. And, you know, the average tour takes about 20 to 30 minutes. When we're doing full workshops, we do workshops that can last an entire afternoon. We've done workshops that have went over a weekend period where we're doing a variety of different things each day. So it really depends upon what the people who ask us to come are expecting of us and what they have the ability to host.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and tell us a little bit about this Permibus.
Well, we're on Permibus 2 right now. The original Permibus, which we went on the road with in February of 2007, was a 40-foot diesel-powered former school bus, which we bought school bus yellow with all the seats still in it, and we pulled all the seats out, painted it green, and put a solar system on board to run things like the electricity and run some of our power tools. We have a gray water system on board. We also carry 3 hens with us that we use as part of our composting system. We have a little herb garden on board, and we have a humanure toilet system. That bus, unfortunately, developed a cracked piston last November, and so what we've done is we've bought the second Permibus, the Permibus 2, which is basically the same thing. It's a school bus. It's diesel-powered, so we can run it on biodiesel, and right now we're in the process of taking all the systems that were in the old bus and retrofitting them for the new bus so that we can be on the road again.
Mm-hmm. So there's teaching done on the bus. There must be teaching materials of some sort.
We have a lot of different graphics, and we have a lot of written materials that we use, and we also use our computer. We have slideshows and PowerPoints, and, you know, high-tech to low-tech. We have the solar system is set up so that it's a teaching tool. We can show people how to set up gray water systems by showing them our gray water system. Everything is designed in the bus so that you could replicate it in your home or in another vehicle or in whatever, you know, whatever way it is that you want to implement that particular system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How many people travel around on this bus?
We have a full-time crew of 3. It's my family, my wife, and my daughter and I.
Uh-huh.
And then last year, for about 2.5 months, we took on an intern, so we had a crew of 4. We can handle, you know, up to 5 or 6 people.
All right. So it's the size of a school bus.
Yes, it is. We have right now, it's a 37-foot school bus.
And how often are you on the road? Is this a permanent residence?
It is our permanent residence right now. Right now, we're at what we refer to as the garaging location for the bus, what we're doing the rebuilding. But we went on the road in February of 2007, and we stayed on the road until November of 2008. And when we go on the road,
wow,
this time, we'll be on the road all year. We'll probably take a couple of months off at some point and then go back. And we're committed to doing the tour for as long as people want us to.
Yeah. And how widely have you traveled?
In February of 2007, we left San Francisco. We were up above San Francisco, and we ended up as far east as Maine, and we went down south as far as America's Georgia.
Uh-huh.
And so we've been back and forth pretty much across the entire country.
Yeah.
I think we figured it was 30 states in 8.5 months.
You said you would be going to the West Coast?
Going to the West Coast the end of this month, the end of February. We'll be at the Earth, Land, Air, and Water Conference at the University of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will be going up to Olympia, Washington. We're hoping to get up to the Seattle area, and then we'll be making our way down the coast south through Oregon and into California.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we'll probably end up going into the southeastern United States again and going through Texas. We didn't get to Texas last time. There's a couple of, there's some states that we didn't make it through. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to do more in the south.
And how do people contact you to get you to come out their way?
What we do is initially what we did is we had an announcement that we put together and we sent it out to email list, and we asked all the people we knew who had email lists to send that out to their email list. Right now, we have an email account. We also have a website that we're just getting up, and then oftentimes we get contacted by phone after people have seen some of our materials online. And we have a website at permibus.org, and we also have a blog up that you can get to via our website.
And do you ever hear back from people or go to visit again if you're back through that way to see how things are going?
Well, that's what we plan on doing a little bit of this year. We really haven't had much of an opportunity in the first year and a half we were on the road because we were always going to new places.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things we're looking forward to is going back to some of the places we've been before and see how people are doing.
Yeah, that'll be exciting.
Yeah, that is. It's going to be really, we've had email messages from people. We've given them canning workshops. We had some folks in Columbus, Ohio, who we gave a canning workshop to, and they were dumpster diving a lot of fruit, and what they were doing with the food they were dumpster diving is that they were turning it into, they were blending and turning it into fruit drinks as quickly as they could to make use of it. Then we did a canning workshop, and we found out that they've been canning just about everything they can get their hands on. So we got a lot of people through the Midwest who are doing a lot of canning, and we've had a couple of opportunities to actually share in some of the food they've canned. It's really, really exciting to be able to go back to people and see what they're doing and mm-hmm. share in their endeavors.
Right. Well, this is a really great idea, especially with the economy going where it is. I really like what you're doing. Thank you for taking some time to speak with us. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, we look forward to seeing everybody out there on the West Coast. So, if you see a big green school bus going down the road that says Skills for the New Millennium Tour, it's probably us. So, pull us over and say hello.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
This concludes our episode of Sustainable Futures. Thank you, Maria, for being here with me today. And
thank you, Ryan, for being here with me today.
And I hope you enjoyed this episode of Sustainable Futures and that you feel a little more inspired and dedicated for the cause of sustainability than you had about an hour ago when the show started.
So this is Maria Fastadel.
And this is Ryan Fletcher.
And we're wishing you
a sustainable future.